My name is Ben Burrell, and this is Bob Dylan Album by Album, a podcast that brings you an in-depth look at each Bob Dylan studio recording record by record. Unusually, I want to start the podcast by looking at a little bit of Bob Dylan news. I've just been reading about the upcoming biopic, which has been kind of like stalled and has been off and then has been on again for a long time now. It looks like Timothy Chalamet is still going to play Bob Dylan. Some people, well, at least I've seen quite a few people online saying they're not too happy with that. It doesn't seem like a popular choice within the Bob Dylan fan base. I don't know. I think he's fine, isn't he? He's been pretty good in stuff I've seen. The latest news on this, though, is that it looks like he's going to sing in the film, which may actually disprove my theory of him being fine. We shall see on that. Hopefully it's another Joaquin Phoenix situation. I don't know. Anyway, we'll see on that. That is coming, I don't know, I think next year, apparently. It's going to go into production this summer. That's what we're hearing. We shall see on that. Thank you for your messages on the last episode of this podcast. Some people were saying that that Rebecca Black song Friday is actually not a Bob Dylan original. And to you, I say, you're wrong. And how dare you? I have received some disappointed emails. Hi to Luke, though, who said this is the best episode of the podcast ever. I cried at one point. So there you go. Also, thank you for your Buy Me A Coffee donations. Thank you so much for tipping the podcast. You can too. There's a little link in the episode's description, as always. John, nice one for your wealthy donation. Thank you. Vincent, who I believe, judging by their email address, is in Belgium. Thank you for your huge donation as well. Hello to Eamon Keane in, looks like, Dublin, maybe. Hi to Matt. Hello to Alex and Kevin McCormack. Hello. Joe Duncan, thank you very much. Hello to Michelle, thank you very much. And hi to RJ, thank you for your donation as well. If you want to tip the podcast, you can do that. There's a link in the episode's description. Also, don't forget to give us a rating and a review as well, if you can. It is more than appreciated. Thank you. Let's crack on with today's episode, shall we? Let's go back to an interesting album in Bob's career. This is the sort of album from sort of 1975. This is The Basement Tapes.
Well, that big dumb blonde with a wheel gorged turtle, that friend of hers with his checks all forged and his cheeks in a chunk with his cheese in the cash. They're all gonna be there at that $1 million bash.
Dylan isn't a normal artist. He doesn't do things normal artists do. He doesn't do them in a way they do them either. He does surprising things like, I don't know, Victoria's Secret commercials, for example, or Christmas albums. He changes style and approaches, and he hates being labelled. So when it came time to have a breakdown, Bob wasn't off to the Priory, or he wasn't heading to a jail cell. He was at home, writing what could be considered some of his best work. We all know the Basement Tapes origin story. Dylan is on a career high. He's just released the trio of Bringing It All Back Home, Highway 61 Revisited, and Blonde on Blonde. And he had exhausted himself from a grueling tour. He also had a motorcycle crash on July the 29th, 1966. While we could spend hours considering the finer details of that crash and what is true and what's not, or even if the thing actually happened in the first place, the point is the accident made for the perfect metaphor for Bob's career. He had been going at 100 miles an hour, and he was due to come off the road in spectacular style. Drugs and shows and calls of Judas had taken its toll, and whether he engineered it or not, he finally found a moment of rest. What would follow would be domesticity and albums that would soundtrack that. But before he moved forward, Bob went back. He reconnected with his former backing group, who themselves were starting to enter a fertile time as the band. The members of the band, Rick Danko, Richard Manuel and Garth Hudson, joined Robbie Robertson in Woodstock in February 1967. Robertson was living in a house there, and he was there with his future wife. Dylan himself wasn't actually too far away, recovering from that crash and editing his infamous tour film, Eat the Document. It's during this period that the sessions for the Basement Tapes begin, or more appropriately, the sort of sessions begin. Because The Basement Tapes isn't a proper album in the sense that a band went into the studio to record some songs. The Basement Tapes is an ongoing jam session. It's a collection of demos. It's a vibe. It's a freewheeling good time, all in one. Somewhere between March and June 1967, they began to record some jams in Dylan's Red Room. A room that, surprisingly, was not red, but had been at one point and the name had just sort of stuck. Here they record songs like Edge of the Ocean and Roll on Train and Spanish is the Loving Tongue. A lot of these would end up on the Basement Tapes Complete, and a lot would end up on unofficial bootlegs both before and after. It's not until May that they really start thinking about cutting songs that would make the actual album. Times and dates are not available for the most part when it comes to this record. You know, it might surprise you to learn that these group of rock stars in the American countryside jamming day and night away from the world didn't write down who did what and who did what when, so that little dweebs could recount it on a podcast decades later. Yes, I'm surprised too. What we do know though is in May they move recording to Big Pink, a now legendary house. Then it was just a place that a few of the band were staying, but now it's written into the history of popular music. The house got its name due to its pink sidings and would go on to not only play a huge role in the Basement Tapes, but in the debut for the band, who included the house's name into the title of their first long player, Music from Big Pink. But they went even further. The album is also made up of songs and ideas from the Basement Tapes too. And that's exactly what these sessions were supposed to be. The band and Dylan weren't really working on songs for a collaborative album. They were making demos for other artists. So in actual fact, the jamming feeling, the boys in the treehouse idea of the Basement Tapes actually has a slightly more commercial heart to it. In a 1969 interview with Rolling Stone, Bob said, "They weren't demos for myself, they were demos of songs. I was pushed again into coming up with some songs. You know how these things go." And while that appears to be true, there was also a sense of those sessions being a knockabout at the same time. The sessions really do appear to be the band hanging out and having a good time, but also with one eye being on the commercial side of things. A song that appears on both the previously mentioned albums in different forms is Tears of Rage, a Dylan original when it comes to the lyrics, but musically a Richard Manuel composition. The lyrics feel very relevant to Bob's situation at the time. The story is framed as a conversation between what we assume is a father and his daughter. While this might not be a literal father-daughter story, it's racked with guilt and bitterness. Dylan sings, "Tears of rage, tears of grief, why must I always be the thief? Come to me now, you know we're so alone, and life is brief." There's a great feeling of regret through these verses, particularly on the lines of, "We pointed you the way to go and scratched your name in the sand, though you just thought it was nothing more than a place for you to stand. I want you to know that while we watched, you discovered no one would be true, that I myself was among the ones who thought it was just a childish thing to do." Many have linked this song to Shakespeare's King Lear. In that play, there is a similar father-daughter relationship. In the first act of the famous play, King Lear of Britain, elderly and wanting to retire from the duties of the monarchy, decides to divide up his realm amongst his three daughters. He declares he will offer the largest share to the one who loves him the most, which is, you know, a bit needy, but fine. The first two daughters play along until we get to his youngest and his favourite, Cordelia. At first, she refuses to say anything. "Nothing, my lord," is the line in the play. And then she declares there is nothing to compare her love to, no words to express it properly. She says honestly but bluntly that she loves him, according to her bond, no more, no less. And she'll reserve half her love for her future husband. Infuriated, Lear disinherits Cordelia and divides her share between her elder sisters. If the play and the song are linked, and I don't think it's out of the question to think that they are, then Dylan himself was feeling a little bit like that old king, burnt out, now in this new domestic setting, looking over a great life. And while Dylan was still very young at the time and nowhere near retirement himself, Bob has lived multiple lives, and one of his most frenetic had just come to an end on that Woodstock road with his motorbike a few yards behind him. Not all the songs on this album are Dylan originals. There's some pretty much band-only songs. In fact, Graham Marcus describes the album's contents as 16 Basement Tapes recordings plus 8 band demos. Side 2, Track 2, Bessie Smith has a little bit of a hazy history, according to Rob Bowman, a professor of music. He said it was apparently, sort of probably, recorded in an unknown studio in late 1968. However, engineer Rob Fraboni asserts that Bessie Smith was recorded by the band in 1975 in their Shangri-La studio in Los Angeles, as the Basement Tapes was being prepared for its official release. What we do know is the track was written by Rick Danko and Robbie Robertson.
Bessie was more than just a friend of mine. We shared the good times with the band.
Track 2 from Side 1 is another example of this. Its title is Orange Juice Blues, a bluesy jaunt written by Richard Manuel. It was laid down in 1967 with some overdubs coming 8 years later, including some welcome saxophone. Another song, the Robertson-penned Yazoo Street Scandal, features some great vocals and some interesting instrumentation, in which you can hear the band really nailing what will become their trademark sound. Robertson has explained that this song was based on an actual Yazoo street. It was in Arkansas. He said, "I thought, wow, they don't have streets like that in Canada. There's no streets up there called Yazoo. It was like, Jesus, let me make up a little story here about stuff going on in this kind of almost, I don't know, red light district." It's similar territory once again on the track Katie's Been Gone, a Manuel Robertson composition and another song that has a foggy history. But this one has been called one of the first band songs. It features a descending melody, something that Dylan himself has developed into a trademark over the years.
Katie's been gone and now her face is slowly fading from my mind. She's gone to find some new places.
The third song on the third side, Ain't No More Cain, is a traditional southern prison work song. Levon Helm learned this from his father whilst growing up in Arkansas. It had been recorded by several artists before the band, including Dylan and the band favourite, Leadbelly. Again, it's suggested that this song was actually cut in Shangri-La in their studio, which is now under the ownership of Rick Rubin and is one of the most in-demand studios in the world, still bearing the band's tour bus as a recording booth in the garden, by the way. It seems to have been cut there years later after the initial Dylan and band sessions. This song features another great vocal, and a great vocal harmony too. And dare I say it, there's a good, I don't know, vibe, for want of a better phrase, with that accordion.
It's all been ground down to molasses. You should have been on the river in a 1910.
Two tracks later, we have Reuben Remus, another Manuel Robertson cut that is not as well recorded as the others here and sounds like it comes from early on in the sessions. In between these two songs is a Dylan original. It's called Crash on a Levee, and Bob takes inspiration from When the Levee Breaks, a Memphis Minnie and Kansas Joe song, and a tune that Dylan has returned to a few times in his career. They sang, "Oh, crying won't help you, praying won't do no good, when the levee breaks, mama, you got to move." Bob takes this and throws in some rapturous undertones for good measure. He sings, "Now it's sugar for sugar and salt for salt. If you go down in the flood, it's gonna be your fault." This is all over some nice keyboard and a bass line that really jumps around.
There's a crash on the levee and mama, you've been refused. Well, it's sugar for sugar and salt for salt. If you go down in the flood, it's gonna be your fault. Oh, mama, ain't you gonna miss your best friend now? Yes, you're gonna have to find yourself another best friend somehow.
This period of Dylan's life seems especially attached to the Bible. His mum is quoted from this time talking about his fascination with reading and rereading the book time and time again. And that's also present on track 7, Lo and Behold. The actual phrase that makes up the song's title is said to have its origins in the King James Bible. In fact, it's been called one of the key phrases of the Old Testament prophets in the King James Bible. The actual quote is, "And Abraham said, Behold, to me thou hast given no seed, and lo, one born in my house is mine heir."
The coachman, he hit me for my hook, and he asked me my name. I'll give it to him right away, and I hung my head in shame. Lo and behold, lo and behold, looking for my lo and behold. Get me out of here, my dear man.
We cruise through some nice melodies and the sort of backing track that Dylan was about to leave behind as he enters the next phase of his career. A key track for me in all of this is track number 3, Clothesline Saga, originally titled Answer to Ode. There's a thought that this song is a kind of answer to a popular song called Ode to Billy Joe, a Bobby Gentry song, hence the original title.
It was the 3rd of June, another sleepy, dusty Delta day.
Ode to Billy Joe was a big hit. Bobby even appeared in Life magazine, that's how big it was. The story of it is the suicide of someone called Billy Joe McAllister. It's told by a young woman who had something to do with the boy's death. She is somehow involved, or something has happened, but you never quite find out what. That's the secret. The secret of the song is it's a secret. It's a kind of who shot JR for its day, if you like. However, whilst initially this Dylan song was labelled as an answer to this popular tune, it really wasn't an answer to it at all. It was more of a joke, more of a kind of parody.
Just some old wild shirts and a couple pairs of pants which nobody really wanted to touch. Mama come in and picked up a book, and Papa asked her what it was. Someone else asked, what do you care? And Papa said, well, just because. And they started to take back their clothes, hang them on the line. It was January the 30th.
And while this is a new song, it very much echoes an older style. In fact, in these sessions, they blurred the lines between the old music of America and new compositions, something the band themselves would go on to do in stunning fashion. They turned their back on the music of the day, or what was popular at that particular moment with the vast majority of bands, and they went back to their roots. But they did something different with that music. They reinterpreted it and made it, dare I say, even better. In Graham Marcus's book on the Basement Tapes, he says Dylan found common ground with the stories in many of the covers during the Basement Tape sessions. He found a kinship with the people who wrote them and the people who were in them. People like Doc Boggs, a hardened coal miner and banjo player. He was like the Appalachian Robert Johnson, apparently. He made music about death and painted himself as an outlaw, so obviously Dylan was a fan. He loves an outlaw. So once again, like we've seen countless times with Bob, he is exploring the roots of American music here, with his friends this time. In a career break, he's fishing for ideas and theories from the past, mining his country's musical history as he does. On Clothesline Saga, while, as I say, this is a new song, it definitely browses and echoes from before, from the people of his land, from the artistry that came before him. This kind of track embodies the Basement Tapes for me. It started out life as nothing at all, a half joke, a reply to something very popular, a parody. You feel this was never intended really to see the light of day, but it, like its parent album, managed to be presented to the world. It became worth listening to because of its situation in my mind. It might have started out life as a throwaway thing or an exercise to get to somewhere else, but the very nature of that has set the artists free. If Dylan had sat down and tried to write a load of songs like the ones here on the Basement Tapes, he would have been crushed by his and our expectation, or by trying to create something, especially with the band. But because this was just a knockabout type situation, songs that they were never going to present themselves, ironically, without any pressure or expectations, we have something that is really good. This album can only come from this circumstance. It's a true result of its context, and it's a true one-off. And while for me it doesn't make the mythical grade that many issue it with, it's a timely reminder that when someone is a good artist, they need to be set free, because great things can happen. In a world where Dylan has changed music forever, here he was with the shackles off, and it did him no end of good. For a long time, these songs lay dormant in a few different places over the years, including in Garth Hudson's possession. There's a wonderful Rolling Stone article about this little subplot that is definitely worth a Google, and at times is actually quite moving. Despite some relentless bootlegging and some songs from these sessions being recorded by others, including the band, as we've covered, somewhat surprisingly, in 1975, just after Bob had made his first major comeback with Blood on the Tracks, he agreed for these set of songs to be released. Exactly why, we don't know. There's probably a few reasons, though. I feel that with the success of Blood on the Tracks, Dylan might have seen these songs as a classic Dylan oddball follow-up. He knew that they had merits, but crucially, I think he also knew that for the most part, they were very different to his recent Platinum Hall of Famer album. But it wasn't all plain sailing. There was criticism of the 1975 Basement Tapes album, though. It centred on two issues: the recording by the band on their own, and the selection of Dylan's songs. Critic Michael Gray writes of the album, "The interspersed tracks by the band alone merely disrupt the unity of Dylan's material, much more of which should have been included. Key songs are missing, including I Shall Be Released and The Mighty Quinn." And, well, he is right. There are two or more really good songs that aren't on this album that probably should have been, but some of the band tracks shouldn't be dismissed as just breaking up Dylan's role. There's some good stuff from the band on here. There are interesting additions, but I have to say, and I would say this, Bob's songwriting definitely does dominate. At times, he's head and shoulders above the rest. There's also a bit of a feeling of disengagement from Dylan when it comes to the album released in 1975 too. Once he had given the go-ahead for the album's actual release, engineer Rob Fraboni was brought to Shangri-La Studios to clean up the recordings from the years before. Robbie Robertson was described as the dominant voice in selecting the final tracks for the actual album, and it was reported that Dylan wasn't really in the studio very often. The original stereo recordings made by Hudson were remixed to mono, while Robertson and the other members of the band overdubbed new keyboard, guitar, and drum parts onto some of the 1967 Woodstock recordings. Four new songs from the band were also recorded in preparation for the album's official release, one of which, a cover of Chuck Berry's Going Back to Memphis, actually in the end didn't make the grade. Once again, there's a foggy history with the songs and recording dates. There's a few different accounts, and listening by ear, it's almost impossible to spot the difference between the songs that are recorded years apart and spotting the overdubs that are added much later. Ultimately, 8 of the 24 songs on the Basement Tapes did not feature Dylan. There's often moaning and griping about the final song choice from all different sides, but the fact of the matter is that during the compiling of the actual released official album, not every song was available. Robertson explains. He says, "We had access to some of the recordings. Some of the things came under the heading of homemade, which meant a Basement Tapes to us, but not everything was there." They cleaned up, though, what they did have, and soon the album was out. It seems that Dylan, with this album, finally got what he wanted with the Self-Portrait LP, to a degree. This was a great official bootleg. It's got it all. Quality, little gems, some imperfect, perfect moments. Like I said at the start of this episode, Bob is a strange artist, a unique one. What other artist records a load of material with his former backing band that are about to go big, leaves that material lying around for years, then releases it with only one foot in the studio and watches the whole thing become a big success? This album would go gold in both the UK and the US. It breached the top 10 in both territories too. Surely no one would have seen that coming when they stepped into the Red Room all those years ago. Thank you for listening to this episode. What do you think of the Basement Tapes? For me, it's a little bit like what we were talking about with the previous album on this podcast, Tempest. I think it's a brilliant, brilliant record. I can see why people love it, but I can't fall in love with it. My heart's not in this album. I don't know why. Maybe it's just because I'm not as big a fan of the band as a lot of other people. But like I say, I can appreciate it. There's dear friends of mine that love the Basement Tapes album and think it's Dylan's best, actually. Probably because they're more fans of the band, I guess. But yeah, it's not an album that I can absolutely fall in love with. And I'm assuming that you picked that up during this episode. I do like listening to it, though. It's a nice kind of gear change album when it comes to Dylan's back catalogue. It's not an album that's completely his, but I do really consider it part of his back catalogue. But yeah, I do listen to it from time to time. I do enjoy it from time to time as well. Do share your thoughts on the album, though. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter, as always, at Bob Dylan Podcast. That is it, as I say, for this episode. Thank you for listening. Next week, we are going on to our final album. I can't believe it. It's the final album next week. And we're going to spend 5 episodes looking at Bringing It All Back Home. And what an amazing record. That is the first Dylan album I actually bought. I think probably the first Dylan album I really fell in love with. I think it's an incredible, incredible record. I think there's some absolutely stunning songs on it. We're going to have a look at those songs. I'm going to do a special line-by-line episode on It's All Right Ma as well, because I think it's such a fascinating song to look at line-by-line. So we'll do that as well. That is all coming up over the next few weeks on the podcast. I will see you then. Take care.